In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
So glad you're joining us today. As every week, we help you get a little more intelligence on big government. Today's show is a split show with two guests. In the second half, we'll be talking with one of the lawyers on Judicial Watch's lawsuit against Oregon to force them to clean up their voter rolls. You know, follow the law. Why don't laws apply to people in government, especially election integrity laws? Many of us have been waiting for Oregon to fix its elections, starting with cleaning up its voter rolls. Inflated voter rolls is an invitation to cheat. But there was a rather odd statement from Oregon, a couple of them. Did Oregon just blow their own case? Stick around for that. But in the first half of the show, it's the lies of climate change and green energy and the lies to prop them up. Green energy and climate change spending appear to be on the way out, which is hugely important because it's been a slush fund for the far left for decades, hundreds of billions. If you want to know why Democrats are able to quickly organize these staged resist democracy protests this weekend, you can thank global warming. Because tax money for climate change goes to leftist companies, far-left NGOs, far-left organizations, and far-left activists, who all work and organize to get Democrats elected. Think about it. Do you see these mass, organized national protests from the right? No, because the right has not been given hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars. Just think what, the Oregon Republican Women's Group could do if someone gave them just $1 million. They could hire full-time staff, hire marketers and strategists and organizers, and sock away some of it to earn interest in perpetuity. And $1 billion could fund 1,000 Republican women's groups all across the nation, 20 of them in every state. That's what the left has been doing. And now that they could be losing not just $1 billion, but hundreds of billions, they are losing their minds. And that's why you're seeing these staged protests. In the scam of climate change and green energy, there is a new wrinkle in untangling the American taxpayer from green energy after some emails the Biden administration tried to keep hidden came to light, giving waivers to wind farms, absolving them of their decommissioning liabilities. Are people in key positions in the Trump administration trying to keep climate change on life support? There is some newly discovered manipulated data when the Biden administration didn't get the results they wanted, typical for pushing climate change or any other propaganda. And there is a RICO trial underway in the largest environmental fraud in California history after a scientist there fabricated data and faked restoration projects. To talk about all that, or to try to, I'd like to welcome back Craig Rucker. He's the president of the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow, or CFACT. Craig, thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Hey, Mark. It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start with that new wrinkle recently uncovered, these waivers. And to nutshell this, when a company gets a contract to put up windmills, the company has to give financial assurances that should something happen to that windmill or to decommission it when it hits the end of the lifespan, that company will have to have the means to pay for all of that. But now these emails show that the Biden administration granted waivers to some windmill companies when that eventuality did in fact happen. A blade flew off and shattered all over a Nantucket beach. But once again, green energy proves that it is not good for the environment. They can pollute beaches with shattered wind blades, kill whales, and otherwise destroy the environment. But don't ask them to pay for it. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I tell you, the windmill companies that were putting up these wind farms, a lot of them aren't even American. They come from European countries like Equinor, Avangrid, all these different ones, Ørsted, are Norwegian companies, Danish companies, British companies. They sought deals, and Biden wanted to make climate change his number one policy. Mm-hmm. So he set about creating something he called a 30 by 30 plan, which was to put 30,000 megawatts of offshore wind, for example, off our coast by the year 2030. To do that, he had to fast track these plans because they were certainly attracting a lot of local opposition at the time. So what he did was, one of the most important things you have to do is get permitting. He fast-tracked that, kind of bypassed the Endangered Species Act for the most part. We're actually suing an offshore wind company in Virginia called Dominion Energy because they basically were allowed to harm whales, turtles, sea porpoises, things that oil companies would never be allowed to do. But he, in addition to that, one of the major costs for anything, whether it's an oil rig that's going up offshore or any sort of power plant, is you have to have a decommission plan. Well, the Biden administration basically said that would be a liability for them to achieve the president's objective of 30,000 megawatts by the year 2030, and it's unnecessary, so they waived it. And right now, for the most part, a lot of these companies can really, if they can't afford something around $191 million or whatever it is to put out the decommission their plants, wind farms, they can just go to the taxpayers or ratepayers and get those funds. They got very much a sweetheart deal that would never be offered pretty much any other firm, except for those involved in quote unquote green energy.
Yeah. Well, here's, I think, maybe the really galling part of this. A board member for a Nantucket-based group that is opposed to offshore wind development said it costs as much, if not more, to decommission than it does to build it. And he said it could cost billions of dollars. And I don't know that the average person, including people who support green energy, really know that fact.
I mean, I suspect bureaucrats who push these and the elected officials who voted to give away taxpayer cash either didn't know this or kept it hidden as part of the true cost of these monstrosities. Were decommissioning costs somewhere in their financial analysis, and were those costs included? And exactly how much money they said clean green energy would save taxpayers?
It's a case by case basis, Mark. Every wind farm operator up and down the coast has its own deals. So I know in the case of Virginia, I think there comes to about $10 billion to construct it. I don't believe it would be that much to deconstruct it, but I don't even know as our state has a decommission plan. I don't even know if that had to even be talked about, because I tried to obtain it, and to this date, we have no clue what it is, and I don't think Dominion does either. So that's different than Empire Wind, let's say, in New York, or Revolution Wind off of Rhode Island, or Vineyard Wind off Massachusetts. Each one of these have their own kind of deals, and for the most part, they're all similar in the sense that the liabilities are generally either paid for by the federal government in some cases, like the Inflation Reduction Act covered a lot of things that would not typically be covered, or they would have sweetheart deals that the ratepayers might, as we just learned with these memos, be on the hook for the decommissioning component of it. So it was all designed just to fast track it, get it out there on the ocean as quickly as possible, so that an incoming administration would have a difficult time trying to stop it. And of course, Trump put a moratorium on it on January 20th, right when he got into office. But there's four wind power companies that are proceeding full speed ahead, trying to put it up, hoping that if they get it up, there's nothing that they can do to take it down. Yeah. So we'll see. A lot of this is coming to a head this summer, as there's a lot of lawsuits against these wind farms. We'll see where the Trump administration comes out. I was encouraged by them stopping construction on Empire Wind, but then the president had a deal with Governor Hochul from New York. Yep. I guess he gets a colonial pipeline put into the Northeast, and he'll let her continue. I hope that is not a template for the rest of the remaining projects.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. In fact, I'd like to talk to you about that coming up. If they don't have to pay for the disposal costs, effectively, you can really see why the left loves these. They get all of the profits and none of the risk or liability that any other company would have to take on. All right, coming up, we'll be talking about a surprising fact that never should have allowed these offshore windmills to be put up in the first place. That's next with Craig Rucker, the president of CFACT. And welcome back. We're talking today to Craig Rucker. He's the president of CFACT, Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. Their website is cfact.org. And on today's show, we're talking about the lies and fraud of green energy. And before we get to the next topic of people in the administration potentially undermining Trump's effort to get rid of climate change spending, there was one other issue about these windmills I want to talk to you about. In April, the Government Accountability Office released a report warning that, quote, wind turbines can reduce the performance of radar systems used for defense and maritime navigation. You know, and that was news to me. I knew constructing these windmills could harm whales and their sonar,
I don't think I knew that windmills could interfere with radar. And, you know, isn't that nice? I mean, who's our enemy? China. Where does so much of our materials for windmills come from? China. Where did Joe Biden get millions of dollars from? China. Who pushed for offshore windmills? Because I guess we ran out of land on which to put them. Well, that'd be China, Joe Biden. So call me a conspiracy theorist, but placing these big whooshing towers that could interfere with radar off our shorelines doesn't seem like a very good idea.
And you are spot on. I am actually aghast that this ever got put up. Even under the very woke, politically correct Biden administration, the military squawked about putting offshore wind in a number of these places. And one of the reasons was, of course, they interfere with their navigation. Another was where they place them. And I can tell you in Virginia, which is where we're kind of laser focused on, they put it right near the Norfolk Naval Base. Mm. And you can picture if you have, I mean, that's if there ever was a national security threat, putting it against our nation's largest naval port is not a good idea. And it gets worse than that. It's not just that it interferes with the communications, which the military complained about, but they actually said Chinese subs could potentially hide themselves in these wind turbine things and be very close to our shores and not even be detected.
Wow.
So there's multiple reasons to be concerned about that. Also, with planes taking off and coming in, they said that they create turbulence and they were afraid of their aircraft being impacted by these things. So there's serious national security threats. This actually gives Trump a good reason to possibly stop some of these projects, because there's a national security implications. And going back a long time ago, the Sierra Club took on the U.S. Navy, and this goes back, I think, to the 1980s, and said that the noise coming from the military submarines and stuff like that impacts whales. And they won a lawsuit only to lose it because the high court ruled that because of national security concerns, that trumps the Endangered Species Act. Well, in this case, national security, and that's really in the province of the president entirely, if he so deems it, could shut these things down in one fell swoop if he wants to use that. And the military would probably be very thankful for that.
Hmm. Yeah. It just seems it's insane that these were even allowed, as you say, that they can hide these subs out there. I hadn't heard that one. Oh, my gosh. Moving on to our next topic, are there people in key positions in the Trump administration trying to keep climate change on life support? And I ask that because Trump has made it pretty clear he wants to detangle the American taxpayer from climate change and green energy. And according to Just the News, back in April, Trump put a moratorium on these offshore wind farms, one of which was Empire Wind off the south of Long Island, saying that the Biden administration had rushed the permitting process without sufficient analysis. But then, just a month later, the Department of Interior reversed that decision without explanation and apparently without any such review that they said they'd wanted. The lawsuit says, quote, the federal government failed to meet its own legal standards for environmental review, species protection, and interagency coordination. These omissions are not procedural. They are unlawful. So what's going on here? I thought windmills full steam ahead, regardless of cost or sense, only happened under Democrat administrations, especially at a time Trump is trying to get rid of them.
Yeah, no, it's amazing that this is occurring. And coming out of the administration, I mean, I wouldn't even just say the administration, really the GOP in general, you have kind of a mixed bag. You have people like running the Department of Energy, for example. I think Chris Wright, solid guy,
yes,
seems to be on the program with what Donald Trump wants to achieve. And I think shares his concerns about, you know, renewables like wind and solar power. You also have Lee Zeldin at EPA, and I think that he has done just a fantastic job in rolling back a lot of the excesses of climate action. Even today, he just rolled back the California waiver, on which tried to force electric vehicles on the people, and has just been a superstar. But you do have Doug Burgum at the Department of Interior. And if you look at his record as the governor of Dakota there, he was very much in favor of a carbon captured pipeline that used eminent domain to seize farming land. He was very much in favor of putting wind turbines up across the state. And these are things a lot of the locals didn't care for and even protested. So I think he has been a good trooper for the most part. Kind of, and his tweets have been good. I've been actually following what he's saying. He kind of parrots the president entirely in terms of that. But what has he actually done? He's supposed to be reviewing the permits for some of these remaining projects. And specifically, we're talking Revolution Wind off Rhode Island, Empire Wind off New York, Vineyard Wind off of Massachusetts, and Dominion Energy. These projects are continuing on, despite the president's executive order. And I'm not entirely sure the president realizes that. He's of the opinion, from everything I heard, even today, Trump made a comment during the press briefing dealing with the California waiver that he said, we're not going to see any more wind farms go up. I almost wish we could. And that was on Fox News. I almost wonder if they should have put a little asterisk next to that, except for these projects, you know?
Yeah, except for the ones Burgum approved. So Burgum is the head of the Department of Interior. He believes in climate change. I guess the real question is, do you trust him? And how much faith do you have in him that he will, in fact, push through the Trump agenda?
I'm concerned. I think that, I don't know if his heart's in it. I mean, I think he's trying to be a good soldier to a degree, but I don't know as though he shares the same concerns about these renewables. And I'm not even sure he's not somebody who maybe buys into a little of the climate hype. I don't know. He's good on a whole host of issues. Unfortunately, being at Interior, he plays a major role in trying to stop these projects. And I'm concerned.
Yeah. Okay, let's go and take a break there. To create the lie of climate change, you need good propaganda, and that involves fraudulent claims supported by fraudulent data. We'll talk about two of the latest as Trump tries to free America from the shackles of climate change and green energy. More with Craig Rucker, president of CFAC. And welcome back. We're talking today to Craig Rucker, the president of CFAC. You can follow the great work they do, sign up for their newsletter, and so much more by heading to CFAC.org. That's CFACT.org. Link that up on today's show page, which is 15-24 on iSpyRadio.com. And we've been talking today about the lies of green energy and climate change. Be sure to stick around for our next guest, Eric Lee, an attorney on the Judicial Watch lawsuit against Oregon to actually follow the law and clean up its voter rolls. Fraudulent voters leads to election fraud. Craig, it's not science if you change data to get the results that you want. And if you do that in academia, that's fraud. If you do that in business, claiming your product does something that it does not, that's also fraud. And there's a good chance you'll be sued and perhaps even go to jail. But not when it comes to government. Government needs its propaganda to push hundreds of billions of dollars out the door into the right hands. And that right there is climate change and green energy, which are built on a foundation of lies. And there was some newly discovered manipulated data when the Biden administration did not get the results they wanted. Energy Secretary Chris Wright confirmed in March that when a study on liquefied natural gas was completed, the Biden administration didn't like what the study said, so they set out to produce one that would support the climate policies that they wanted. Then, in a similar case, the Biden admin was trying to force coal and natural gas power plants to sequester carbon underground, but the Biden bureaucrats needed to get around the stipulation in the Environmental Protection Act that requires that standards must be achievable and at a reasonable cost. And emails were uncovered that showed the Biden admin had hid comments from experts who said the carbon sequester plan isn't effective and is excessively expensive. This is so typical throughout climate change propaganda. I mean, shouldn't it be a crime to mislead the public?
You know, this has been going on for so long, I don't even know where to begin. It's different. It's a weird type of manipulation. A lot of times, and I noticed this going back, now this goes back quite a ways, the acid rain debate and the early days of the climate change debate.
Yes. Yep.
What they often do is what we call press release science. What they do is they produce decent studies. And a lot of times we have a tendency to think that they're entirely bogus studies. Actually, if you talk to the researchers, the executive summaries, press releases, sometimes really don't capture anything that the actual study says. In fact, just the opposite. I remember sitting through an acid rain hearing, and they were saying acid rain is a terrible thing that will absolutely destroy the planet. And I said, okay, so what's the evidence? They said, well, we have acidic lakes. And I said, okay, but these lakes, they scientists said, were more acidic back in the 1700s. They were caused when we'd had land use changes in the east, where there was farming going on that made them alkaline. We fished there and we put fish in there because we had changed the composition of the water, and now they're returning to their pristine natural condition, which is acid dead. I said, well, that doesn't sound like coal plants cost anything, you know? And anyway, they went through this on issue after issue. Trees were more robust in the Northeast, everything else. By the end of the hearing, I walked outside and I said, you know, the net result of this is acid rain is a terrible thing. We need to have a clean air policy to address acid rain. I said, but that none of what they talked about in the thing gave any evidence of that. But all the reporters heard was the executive summary and the conclusions thereof. And similarly, in the climate debate, a lot of the scientists are actually not saying the stuff that the public's hearing. So when the Biden administration changes a lot of what they say, it's not always because they change the data, although what they do, what they change a lot of times is the way that the data is spun so that it gives them some cover. Sometimes they do manufacture data, but I'm just saying that it just depends. I'd have to see on a case-by-case study. I've seen it done both ways. More frequently, I've seen it done where they just mischaracterize what the reports actually say.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned manufactured data, and there's a RICO trial underway in the largest environmental fraud in California history. Stuart Siegel, a scientist at the San Francisco Estuary Institute, not only fabricated data to show there were fewer fish than there were in reality, thus creating the need to do something to save the fish. He then used that fake data to get federal grants to do restoration projects, except he even faked the restoration projects. He didn't do them. This scam has been going on since 1999 and netted over $200 million in grants. He has now fled California to Utah. And once again, fake data by fake scientists for fake problems. This is not the first time you've heard this kind of thing, as you just alluded to. But do you think we'll see more of these fake scientists brought up on RICO charges?
I would hope so. As I say, it is a flagrant problem that's going on. It's very politicized science. You do see that take place in all sorts of areas, you know, where they or they throw out data. You know, they'll refabricate a study that a lot of the temperature trends, for example, in the climate change issue, where they show great warming in the you know, over the course of, you know, the 20th century. Well, the reason they got that warming, because if you just use raw data, for example, you would see that the 1930s were the hottest decade on record. Yep. People may know from their history books that was the Dust Bowl. What they did is they went back and threw out some of the data to, you know, generally the ones that were from the cool rural temperatures. And they got a different reading, you know, it created a different graph, one that was more... you know, friendly to the global warming cause.
Yes.
So when you hear people say that, they always call it, quote unquote, adjusted data. And, you know, whatever the case is, this is the type of thing that you see going on and on and on with the entire environmental community. Or if they don't have the data, they rely on things like climate models or modeling in general is used. And models are kind of garbage in, garbage out type stuff.
Yes.
Really, depending on the programmer, you can get pretty much anything you want to regarding water quality, regarding temperature trends, regarding endangered species. You know, I remember there was a time they were saying we were losing X thousand number of species on the, every single day on planet Earth because of overpopulation and things like that.
Yeah, I remember that.
Greenpeace founder said, can you give me their Latin names? Can you give me what species are being actually extinct? And he said what they are electrons on a hard drive in somebody's office because they don't actually exist. They're all projections.
Yeah. Well, when it comes to climate change, if you committed this kind of adjusted data in the business world, lying about the dangers of something in order to convince the gullible public to buy your products, what would happen to you? You'd go to jail, wouldn't you?
You would, absolutely. But these people are being awarded big grants. And I actually think that's one of the, we cover that in our movie Climate Hustle, which we produced two versions of. And we have scientists saying that there's real pressure on academics to come forward and actually produce alarmist hypotheses that drive grants. And the grants that are given out are not ones that are put for skeptics, but put for those who are promoters of climate hype. I think according to Joanne Nova, she's an Australian researcher who looked at it, it's like an incredible number, like $1,000 to $1, 1,000 given to hype ones and $1 given to anything that would even be loosely considered skeptical.
Yeah, it's incredibly ridiculous. And quite frankly, the whole of government should be brought up on RICO charges for this kind of embezzlement. Craig, unfortunately, we're up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you, Mark. Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're going to switch gears now and talk about election integrity. I'd like to welcome Eric Lee. He is a senior attorney on Judicial Watch's team. He currently serves on the Election Integrity Division there. Eric, it's great to talk to you today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So for those not aware of your case here in Oregon, what are you guys alleging and what is it trying to do?
So as your listeners may be aware, that we have filed a federal lawsuit in the District of Oregon late last year, just before the 2024 general election. And we are alleging that several counties, over half the counties, I believe, in Oregon, have issues with their voter registration list. And the issues are primarily the lack of removals under a provision of federal law that requires you to remove the registration after a certain period of time, and the failure to provide documents that the state is required to provide under federal law. And so those are the two counts of our federal case in Oregon. And we sued the Secretary of State and the State of Oregon, who are both required under the federal law to remove registrations. And the federal law that I'm referring to is the National Voter Registration Act of 1993. That's the Motor Voter Bill. And within the Motor Voter Bill is a provision, Section 8 of the NVRA. It's codified as in 52 United States Code 20507. And there are three provisions in that law that we're concerned about, and that's the election integrity law that Congress mandated states to remove ineligible registrations. The first one is the general program provision, that's Section 8A4, that requires every state subject to the NVRA, including Oregon, to have a general program that makes a reasonable effort to remove the list from the voter registration list, the names of ineligible registrations by reason of death and change of address. Now, there's a provision underneath that, Section 8D1B, that outlines the procedure that the states have to abide by in order to remove a registration that has moved out of the state. And that's the confirmation notice procedure. And the way that works is if the state gets information either from the National Change of Address database, or if they have some other information that the voter may have changed address, or if they just lack voting activity for a certain period of time, the state will actually they're required to send a confirmation notice forwardable to the last known address of the registration on the registration file. Now, they're supposed to track those notices to see how many have received back confirming the registration is valid or invalid or returned as undeliverable. And then they're supposed, if they're returned as undeliverable or they don't receive a response at all, federal law says that states have to inactivate that registration. They have to change that registration from active status to inactive status. And once they do, the NVRA clock, what we call it, starts to tick. And what that means is that under Section 8D1B says that if the inactive registration does not respond to that notice, the forwardable notice I just described, and then does not vote for two general federal elections or otherwise come into contact with the state or registrar or county, that registration must be removed from the official list of eligible voters. They cannot stay inactive. They cannot be moved from active to from inactive to active or active again. They have to be removed. They have to be canceled. And then the problem we see in Oregon is it's really threefold. First, based on public responses that they've given to the Federal Election Assistance Commission in June of 2023, there were problems we found in the data that showed low numbers of these 8D1B removals after the second general federal election, that the EAC tracks this data. They had high overall registration rates, which would indicate that they have more total registrations than eligible citizens. They had high inactive registration rates, so the number of inactives compared to the total number of voters. So that shows that they're leaving, that plausibly alleges that they leave these voters on the inactive list for more than two general federal elections. And then they had no information. They just put on the EAC report, the data not available. They had no information on address notices they received back. So they say they reported to the EAC, they sent a number of notices, X amount, however amount. But every single category that says, did you receive these notices back? Did you receive any notices that are returned as undeliverable? Any that were not responded to? They all the counties, all 36 counties in Oregon left that data, that information blank. They just said data not available. And so that's our, we filed a federal lawsuit in Oregon. We alleged various facts related to the EAC report, and I can go over them in more detail if you want. And then we also allege that they're not keeping the required records that they're required that they're required to disclose under federal law.
Yeah. So, okay. I think Oregon may have harmed its own case, and we'll talk about that more in the next segment. But you just said that Oregon publicly admitted that there's problems with their own data. So why has Oregon, or any state for that matter, failed to comply with the law? And what, if any, is the penalty for failure to comply? In other words, are there any teeth to the law, or is it all just suggestions?
Well, you can. A regular citizen or an individual or an organization can sue in federal court to enforce the requirements of the law. The Congress actually, when they passed the NVRA, they afforded private litigants like Judicial Watch and the Constitution Party of Oregon, who are plaintiffs in this case, as well as two registered voters in the state. One of them is a registered voter of the Constitution Party. Another one's a member of Judicial Watch. But they're both active registered voters in the state, and they have legal rights as that. They can sue to – Congress allowed them to sue in federal court to enforce the requirements of the law. And what you can do is you can obtain an injunction to force the federal – either through a court order or a consent decree or a settlement agreement, enforce the state – to remove these registrations or start complying with the law. In other words, it's just sending the notices, tracking the notices, and then removing them after the second general federal election. Our whole goal here is in this lawsuit is in order to, our whole goal in the lawsuit is actually to enforce the requirements of the federal law. And we can do that either through a permanent injunction, request for a permanent injunction if we prevail on the merits of our case, or through a consent decree like we did in the Commonwealth of Kentucky a few years ago. We actually got a court order consent decree requiring the Secretary of State there to issue notices, track those notices, to have a program in place, because they didn't even have a program when we sued them in 2018.
Yeah, it's astonishing how many of these states are just failing to comply, failing to keep their election rolls clean. All right, let's go and take a break. Did Oregon harm its own case? That's next with Eric Lee, senior attorney with Judicial Watch's team, suing the state of Oregon over its fraudulent voter rolls. And welcome back. We're talking today to Eric Lee. He's a senior attorney with Judicial Watch's election integrity team. He and the rest of the team will be in Oregon's federal court in Eugene this coming Wednesday, June 18th, for their hearing. And just to clear up something, during the break there, you and I were talking, and there are some teeth in that law where if a bureaucrat or state refuses to clean up the voter rolls, having been ordered to do so, they can find that bureaucrat in contempt, and it could include jail time or fines, correct?
Yes, and that's up to the court's discretion. I mean, we're going way ahead. If there's a valid judicial order or a consent decree, and there's an explicit willful violation of that order or consent decree, then the court has the power under their contempt powers to issue fines, issue imprisonment, to enforce that judgment if necessary. Now, it's not ever happened, because usually when you get a court order, the officials do comply. But if they don't, then that's always an option available. It's not in the NVRA itself. It's more for the judge and the court to enforce their powers in equity. And it's the judicial power to enforce an injunction and a permanent injunction or some type of issue in equity. The NVRA itself is a civil statute. It does not provide for it does not allow for any private citizen to enforce it criminally. It only allows for attorney's fees. So it's a civil statute that can find civil violations, but the court can always exercise its powers in contempt if necessary.
Yeah. Okay. The other thing we talked about during the break is that Oregon has several laws, in my opinion, that contradict federal laws. For example, they had told election officials in the various counties that they can decide whether or not to count votes. I think it's up to 10 days past election date. And then they've also got one recently where basically that you can't clean up the voter rolls. Does someone need to remind Oregon that federal laws actually take precedent?
Well, that's what we're trying to do. We are suing to enforce federal law here because under the Elections Clause of Article 1, Section 4, it gives Congress the explicit power to make or alter any conflicting state regulation. And if there's a conflicting state regulation or law that says that you can't remove an act of registration, or you can't remove any registration that may be invalid or not eligible, that's inconsistent with the federal law. And so it would be under a doctrine called preemption. It would be preempted. It would be invalid. That's what we're arguing here. The practice and procedure in Oregon of not removing registrations in a timely manner is invalid under federal law and should be enjoined. It should be stopped. As for the other issue with the late arriving ballots, we're suing now in various states, Illinois, Mississippi, and California, to stop that practice. We don't have a lawsuit in Oregon, but that issue may come up before the Supreme Court because we won in Mississippi. We won at the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, unanimously found that accepting late arriving ballots after Election Day is unlawful under the Election Day statute passed by Congress in 1872 that said that this date is the day of the election in November. That issue may go before the Supreme Court because right now, last Friday, the Mississippi Secretary of State filed his petition for a review of that decision under the Fifth Circuit. He wants the Supreme Court to review that case. And so if the Supreme Court grants the review and decides, then this issue could be decided about late arriving ballots.
Okay, so I can't help but think Oregon has blown its own case here. And just a little quick background. Oregon's Voter Registration and Election Management System is Orvis, and Oregon had hired a company, No Inc., back in 2021 for $10 million to overhaul that Orvis system. But by July 2023, No Inc. was behind schedule and over budget. I mean, 2 years, and they still hadn't fixed it. The problems forced Oregon to revert to using its unreliable and out-of-date voter registration system for the 2024 election. Judicial Watch sued in October 2024, a month before the election. And then right in the middle of your case, in March of 2025, the newly elected Secretary of State, Tobias Reed, put a stop order on that No Inc. contract. It seems to me that stop order effectively admitted and proved that there were and are problems with Oregon's voter rolls and election system. Doesn't that lend a whole lot of credibility and weight to your case?
Well, our allegations in our complaint, I think, are sufficient to render credibility to our case because we've alleged violations that have gone on for the past 2 years that are not being redressed. Now, this could be related to the software that you described, the contract. I'm not sure. It could be related. I'm not. It may not be. The Secretary of State is actually not arguing on our motion to dismiss that's currently before the court, not arguing the merits. They're just arguing standing and jurisdictional issues, not arguing the merits of our claims. And so maybe that's why, I'm not sure, but that's just where we are right now. I think it may explain some of these issues that we've seen, like the 29 counties that have removed zero or fewer than 11 registrations under the 81B procedure for change of address. I mean, we alleged, based on the last Census Bureau estimates for Oregon residents that have moved out of state and moved away from Oregon, 14.5% of Oregon residents are no longer at their previous address they were a year ago. And 29 counties, including a lot of counties that are relatively large, like Multnomah County, that reported zero registrations removed.
Yeah, that's just statistically impossible. Let's go ahead and take a break a little bit early. There's another issue here where I think Oregon may have blown things, but it's going to take a bit to answer. So everyone stay with us. We'll be back with Eric Lee, Senior Attorney for Judicial Watch.
get a little more intelligence on big government. You're listening to the iSpy Radio Show.
And welcome back. We're in our final segment now with Eric Lee, a senior attorney with Judicial Watch's Election Integrity Team. They're going to be in Oregon this Wednesday for their hearing as Oregon seeks to dismiss their case on procedural grounds. And so I mentioned in going out of that last segment there, I think there's another area where Oregon may have sabotaged its own case. And even before your case was filed, Judicial Watch had sent some letters seeking records, and you guys received a response saying, quote, to fulfill your request, it would require, quote, significant additional labor costs to provide a full data set of returned voter notification cards, in part because counties have their own way of doing things. And also they said this, quote, we estimate this work would take approximately 5,000 hours to complete due to the level of customization required for each of the 36 counties in Oregon. So if it takes 5,000 hours to fix that issue, I mean, that is one completely screwed up system. And again, doesn't that add weight to your case?
It does. It adds weight to our second count, which is the violation of the public disclosure provision of the NVRA. NVRA says explicitly, each state shall maintain records concerning the accuracy and currency of the official list of eligible voters. And right underneath of that provision, it says these records shall include a list of names and addresses of every registration that has received a confirmation notice, an address verification notice, and information on whether they responded to that notice. And that's exactly what we sent to the Oregon Secretary of State, asking for these records that they're supposed to maintain. And they come back and saying that it's going to take 5,000 hours to complete. We don't have these records in custody. And the DOJ, the United States, actually submitted just recently a statement of interest in our case, and it's highlighting that issue, saying that the state is required under the NVRA's public disclosure provision to keep these records. They can't delegate it to the counties under the law and absolve themselves of responsibility. And so that's essentially what we allege that they're doing. They're basically casting it off, saying these counties have these records. And
yeah, it's absolutely crazy. I hate to interrupt, but the DOJ filed a statement of interest in your case. What's the impact of that? Does it add any weight to it?
I'm not sure. It depends on the court. It depends on the judge. The DOJ under the Biden administration weighed in on all of our Election Day cases in Illinois and Mississippi. And sometimes the court found it persuasive. Sometimes the court did not. They actually filed a statement of interest saying in our Mississippi case for the Fifth Circuit, they said that the Election Day statute did not require receipt of absentee ballots. And the Fifth Circuit unanimously disagreed with the DOJ and said that the ballots are required to be received by Election Day. And so it depends. It can be persuasive, but it's not. I don't want to say it's outcome determinative. It certainly helps our case because it bolsters our legal reasoning. I'll just say that most courts that confront this issue under the public disclosure provision of the NVRA tend to in favor of the requester, because the Congress actually made the public disclosure provision of records purposely broad. It says that all records concerning list maintenance programs and activities shall be disclosed, not some, all. And there's very limited exceptions to that. And so whenever there's a state law, such as in Illinois, there was a state law that said that you have to, you cannot have access to the voter registration list unless you are a political organization, and they classify a political organization as such. But a citizen could not obtain the voter registration list in Illinois. We got that law invalidated because the NVRA says that these records must be disclosed.
I think that's insane, because if you're trying to say that these are fair election rolls and they're open and transparent, of course you should let people look. We've only got a couple minutes here with you. We have heard from previous interviews that besides people on the rolls who should not be there, there may be cloned voters hidden in the software and the voter rolls through an algorithm. Is Judicial Watch aware of this? And would your lawsuit expose those to ensure that they're removed as well? And then also, how would it help prevent those phantom voters from being put back in?
Well, in any settlement we get, we always get records. We for compliance. So if the state is supposed to remove X number of registrations after a certain amount of time, they have to send us the data to ensure that they do. We did that in Los Angeles and New York and other jurisdictions as well. So that's how we kind of know that they're actually removing the registration from the rolls. Whether they're put back on or whether the data is accurate itself, that's more of a Help America Vote Act issue that requires the information in the statewide registration database be accurate. I know that the DOJ now is filing lawsuits in various states to enforce HAVA's requirement in essence. But whether the voter registration records are accurate is more of a HAVA issue and not an NVRA one. Are accurate with that? Of course, they have to be accurate because they can't. They have to be eligible. But whether all of the information itself is accurately inputted into the database, that's more of a HAVA issue.
Okay. Well, we are going to have you back because there's still so many questions here. I want to wish you the best of luck in your hearing. I cannot say what this lawsuit means to so many people here in Oregon, the ones that want actual election integrity. Eric Lee with Judicial Watch, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Did you catch that figure that Eric mentioned? Based on the last Census Bureau estimates, 14.5% of Oregonians moved out of the state and are no longer at their previous registered address. But Oregon says, trust us, the voter rolls are clean, including counties like Multnomah, the most populous county in Oregon, which has had zero registrations removed. Sure, nobody ever moves out of Portland. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to trust our election system and the voter rolls? Oregon's stance under the Democrats has been, oh, you can totally trust us, the voter rolls are accurate. You just can't look to see. Nowhere in life does that work to build trust in anything. And why on earth has it taken Oregon's contractor almost 4 years to overhaul the state's voter database and election system? For Pete's sake, you could have had this done inside of a month if it had been a simple database like Excel. Isn't that suspicious? And it sure makes it sound like there's something else going on there. You can't trust the computer if you can't trust the software installed on it. Just like you can't trust a database if you can't trust the software interpreting it, especially when they won't let you look at how it does so. There is no question Oregon needs to clean its voter rolls. The law says so. The scam of global warming is how they pay for fake protests and all that Democrat organizing. Election fraud is how they get elected. And while Oregon may want us to think there's no election fraud, well, it's up to them to prove it. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.